We're driven by the search for better. But when it comes to hiring, the best way to search for a candidate isn't to search at all. Don't search, match with Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform with over 350 million global monthly visitors, according to Indeed data, and a matching engine that helps you find quality candidates fast. Ditch the busy work. Use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. Leveraging over 140 million qualifications and preferences every day, Indeed's matching engine is constantly learning from your preferences. So the more you use Indeed, the better it gets. Join more than 3.5 million businesses worldwide that use Indeed to hire great talent fast. And listeners of this show will get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Just go to Indeed.com/Blue Wire right now and support our show by saying that you heard about Indeed on this podcast. That's Indeed.com/Blue Wire. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
What's up, y'all? It's Drewski, and I've teamed up with Mountain Dew to produce a hilarious new basketball podcast called The Dew Zone with Drewski. Learn the backstories of your favorite ballers and celebrities like Jamal Murray.
Did you have like a favorite team? Was it the Raptors at the time or no? Was the Raptors even started around that time?
Come on, bro.
I ain't that old, fam. You're talking like I'm 50.
Taylor Rooks, Asia Wilson, and many more. You won't want to miss this. Listen to The Dew Zone with Drewski on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you listen to podcasts.
The Chase Down Podcast presents A City of Champions, a seven-part series chronicling the Cavs' 2016 NBA championship. With help from fans who cheered against us, reporters who covered it, and the players who watched it, we'll take you game by game through the most improbable 3-1 comeback in championship history. Be sure to subscribe to the Chase Down Podcast to relive the greatest series we've seen in our lifetimes.
One dribble, steps back, puts up a three, won't go, rebound tip taken by Spates, final seconds, it's over, it's over! Cleveland is a city of champions once again. The Cavaliers are NBA champions.
The series begins Thursday, April 9th.
What do you think about the Laker team now?
You follow the box scores of the games every day?
Just the Lakers.
You're kidding. That is really a compliment. I was pleased to see you smile at the top of our show, because once the game starts, you have a game face. You don't smile much out there.
I don't think you have to do things for money anymore.
Correct.
What's up, Laker fans? Welcome to the Laker Film Room Podcast, brought to you by BetOnline.ag. I'm Pete, joined as always by Darius. Today we're going to get to a couple of your mailbag questions in the first segment. And then in the second half, we're going to continue our breakdown of The Wire with what I consider to be the first really great episode of The Wire, episode 4, Old Cases. Really excited about that. We may take a little more time on that because I just love that episode. But first, got two or three really, really good questions from you guys. Thank you for that. We're going to start out with Kevin Feruda asks, what's the biggest difference between how Luke ran the Lakers and how Vogel is now, both from an X's and O's perspective and from dealing with players?
So I'm going to let you dive more into the X's and O's and maybe even the dealing with players part, because one of the things that really stood out to me, or that has stood out to me from Vogel, is that there has been a certain level of consistency with him that has stood out to me in terms of his approach and in terms of sticking to the game plan. One of the things that sort of frustrated me most with Luke Walton, even though I was a supporter of his, was that he sort of jumped around a lot and was too often willing to sort of hedge off of what was the game plan based off of something that he might have seen, and he would get away from something. Like, and an example of it would be how he would sort of switch between like switch active, like switch heavy defenses with certain lineups, and then go back to playing a more traditional drop style. Now, some of that was personnel related, but I feel like having such differences within his defensive scheme in the long run was detrimental to the overall growth of his roster and finding something that they could lean on consistently over the course of a full game. And so that was one thing that I feel like Vogel's been much better at than Walton was.
For that thing in particular, and I think this applies to the defensive end even more than the offensive end, is I've always felt like he was trying to simulate the Warriors and his experience there. And those teams often had two different bigs that would be drop coverage type bigs, and then you'd have your small ball switchy type of lineup. And I thought that just stylistically they could get a little too, just like you said, they would bounce around. One thing with Vogel is I think that his rotations are very consistent. I would argue sometimes to the point of a little frustrating, right? When a guy is outplaying somebody that may need to sit on the bench a little more in that particular game. But I think there's value over 82 in that type of consistency. And I think that within that idea of consistency, you also have, the same stylistic approach from one coverage to another. Even if we've got AD as a small ball five. Now, let's be fair to Luke here. He did not have an Anthony Davis. Those teams were actually solid defensively, right?
Yeah.
I think that offensively was more, I feel, especially in retrospect, that Luke was trying to copy the coaches that he looked up to and the coaches that he worked with rather than internalizing what made that successful and coming up with kind of basketball theories of his own. He was trying to he was like coaching cosplay type of thing, right? One thing I've been very impressed by with Vogel, and I think this plays into the personality aspect as well, is Vogel is very prepared, and he's a lifetime basketball geek that hasn't had anything handed to him. Now, mind you, Luke made it to the NBA, right? He's also Luke Walton, and a lot of advantages come with being the son of an NBA Hall of Famer, whereas I think Vogel had to build up to where he got on preparation. And I think especially with the type of people, and I think that he's earned the respect of very key figures within the organization, LeBron, Anthony Davis, guys like that. Because he's not going trying to be the guy like, all right, guys, everybody listen to me. That's not the type of coach that he is, nor is that the type of coach that we need. We need a guy who's deep in the tape and really understands how to game plan, is collaborative, and understands the amount of work that you can't fake to get into those level of details, and Vogel does that.
Yeah, I think that idea of being prepared is really based off of all of the things that people who have like covered and followed LeBron for most of his career. I think that aspect of being prepared is really one of the few ways to earn his respect as a head coach. And it's not, look, so LeBron is not going to be dictated to, but he wants someone who's going to be collaborative with him, but I also think that he wants someone who is going to coach him. But LeBron can be, from what I understand of him and from watching him now for about a year and a half or so, I think that this is true, is that if you do not earn his respect from being prepared enough to be able to coach him, he is going to start to tune you out a little bit and want to do his own thing more and more because he understands what it takes to be successful. And I'm not sure if Luke ever won him over completely in that way. And I think Vogel did a very good job of doing that early and building those and making those inroads with him very early on. And I think that's mattered a great deal.
No, I think that's absolutely the case. And I think that from an X's and O's perspective, part of that preparation is understanding how to build an offense around LeBron. Vogel has not tried to reinvent the wheel with LeBron the way that, remember all those 1-4 high sets that we had with Luke? And Luke had an inferior roster to what we have this year. But I felt like he was trying to find a solution and he didn't necessarily come up with one when simply sticking to what LeBron has always done best, like move bodies out of the paint. It's 2020. Don't have four across the free throw line extended and have four bodies right in the paint, right? Like let's space the floor as best we can with, again, a different roster, but and create space out of those actions. One thing I like that Vogel has done is we're a very post-centric offense, and we've found a way to be a very efficient post-centric offense, which I think we're going to have less variance in our offense come playoff time, fingers crossed that there is one, than a lot of teams are going to have, especially when you add that additional element of, if we do come back, this is going to be strange. The type of preparation that players are going to have is just, and coaches, is totally different. I think that the simplistic nature of our offense, which sounds like an insult, but it's not, I think that's actually really beneficial to this team. And in a way that a lot of other offenses are built on timing and built on, you know, making sure that everybody's in sync in a way that we're not going to have to be.
No, you have said this a bunch over the course of the season, that the Lakers run almost like this old school 90s style offensive basketball, right? Like, hey, you ever hear of that great idea about giving the ball to your best player and then sort of spacing the floor for him and then letting him work and draw a second guy? Like, hey, that still works even in 2020, right? So I think the point that you made is a very strong one.
All right, so our next question comes from Jay King, who asks, who's one star in the league today, realistically, that you would want to pair with LeBron and AD going down the road?
I want to hear your answer. We were talking about this offline, and I said I was very interested to hear the name that you have here, because we have not talked about stuff like this in the past, right? We've been so engulfed with what this season had looked like and sort of the surprises and then some of our frustrations. But, you know, the teams at the top of the West, man, like, they didn't, in theory, need a third star.
Right.
So I know the question said realistic.
Yeah, realistic is kind of hard, right?
But so let's maybe venture into the unrealistic here, and who's your ideal third guy?
I would love to have Klay Thompson on this team.
Ah, good one.
That dude is the best player in the league at running off of screens. Like, the three-man game between Klay Thompson, because that's the thing that Danny Green doesn't provide, right, is that ability to really just come off and, it, like, he knows exactly how to set his guy up and get himself open. The weaknesses in his game as a ball handler, you know, he obviously had the torn ACL, and we'll see how that impacts him, but he never really did his work off of screens. And when I talk about his work off of screens, what has always been really remarkable to me is his ability to create separation at 6'7", right? He's not some 6'2" dude flying around that is just outrunning everybody. His footwork is phenomenal, and he can catch from any position and make exactly the right pivot to exactly the right spot, and has that incredible quick release, right? And so if you've got that with LeBron's passing and AD's ability to terrorize the front of the rim and pop out himself, and just, like, dude, that trio would destroy the league, man. How about you? First off, what do you think of my Klay?
No, I think that's a great. So that's right in the template of, like, those Miami Heat teams, right? Like, that's like Klay is the Ray Allen guy.
Right.
The thing that you didn't even say about
defense,
is the defense, right? Yeah. Which is what I instantly thought of the shooting, but my next thought was like, oh, like, this is the T2 version of Danny Green, right?
Like, right. Right.
So I chose a similar player type, but a guy who has a little bit more of a diversified offensive game. And my guy is Bradley Beal.
I was thinking him too.
So he's not the shooter that Klay is, and he's not the defender that Klay is, although Beal has not played in sort of a defense first environment. Sure. And I often like to bring high level players into an environment that sort of stresses those things a little bit more, because I think it sort of nurtures those aspects of their game to sort of push them into developing and playing harder.
How different there. Of a player was Pau Gasol in 2008 versus 2010, right? Like we don't ever think about that type of development of like championship level development and guys going from an environment like Washington, right? That's part of the appeal of Klay too, right? Is that dude's a freaking champion, right? Like he was, remember him hopping around on that torn ACL in the hallway, right?
Like, I'm just going to come back in.
It's just a flesh wound, right? I'm coming back in. Like Klay's a killer on top of all of his skills, right? And so, yeah, somebody like Bradley Beal coming from an environment like Washington, I think it's easy to, that's it. The other side of it can be like, there are guys who really do best when they're kind of in anonymously dropping 25 a game in a small market. You know what I mean? It can be hard to come to LA, especially as a third option.
Oh, well, I was going to say it doesn't even need to be like a small market or big market thing. Some guys are just more suited to always being like a number one or a number two on sort of like a middling team versus being a number three or a number four mm-hmm. on like a top team. Like one of the games that they were just showing on in one of those like replay things that they do on Twitter the other day was Indiana finals, right? 2000 finals against the Pacers game four. And who did I see running around out there? Oh, look, it's Glenn Rice.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Right. And I was just like, oh, I remember the little short Glenn Rice era. Mm-hmm. Right. And he was a guy who had been a star. Mm-hmm. Right. Mm-hmm. Like just, he had done it with Charlotte. He had done it with the Heat. He was one of sort of those, if not an all NBA level player, like one of those guys who you penciled into the All-Star line.
Mm-hmm.
He was just that caliber of guy. And then he now has to come in and play in a more regimented system with the Lakers and Phil Jackson. And it wasn't quite there.
No, and it's fewer touches like, too, right? Like he's a third option, clearly.
But to get back to Beal, one of the reasons why I would really want to pair him with LeBron and AD is because he has more of that ball handling capability to sort of be a lead ball handler type on second units. Like, I think Klay would make this version of the Lakers, but the style that they play now, damn near unbeatable. Like, just because he's that caliber of player, I think Beal would allow them to sort of venture outside a little bit more of what they do now and build different types of lineups where the thing that we were sort of excited about when the Lakers signed Dion Waiters. Remember when the Lakers signed Dion Waiters?
Feels like 100 years ago. You know, Markieff Morris is on the team too. I thought about that the other day.
Oh, man.
Ah, we need it back, man.
So, but you know, like that idea of what Waiters was going to bring to the table is like, oh, he could be a secondary shot creator mm-hmm. and he's a guy who you could give the ball to like on the second unit and not have to rely so much on a Rondo type to be a set organizer and someone who calls out plays for you. Like LeBron can go to the bench and you can run two-man game with Bradley Beal and Anthony Davis. You can run pick and roll. You can put the ball in like sort of a caretaker point guard's hands and run Beal off of screens, run two-man game off-ball action between him and AD, while also still really relying on a Beal type to be a primary on-ball shot creator for you as well. And so that's the type of player who I think could really fit well, not only on like this iteration of the Lakers, but on one, like two or three.
Yeah. Years. He's a better long-term fit than Klay for sure. Right. Like you can go some places with Beal and AD, right. And still have a bit of cap space to add a third guy or build a team out from there. Beal's ball handling ability, he's shown that, especially this year with John Wall out, last year and a half really, that he's got those aspects to his game. So yeah, that's probably the better long-term fit, but just for a short term, if Klay comes back healthy, which also that's another, you know, element of it, but yeah, 6 foot seven champion Klay. I've seen that dude just come through too many times in big games and big moments to where there's no doubt, but long-term, Beal's a great choice.
No, and reunite him with his dad.
Oh, yeah, that'd be great. Oh, God, can you imagine those two in L.A.? That'd be amazing. All right, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to come back to, like I said at the top of the show, what I think is the first truly great episode of The Wire. So we're going to take a quick break. We'll be back in a moment. With currently no NBA, NHL, or MLB, you might think there's nothing to bet on, but you'd be wrong. Our exclusive partner still has hundreds of sports, events, and games to wager on. Or let them bring Vegas to you with their online casino and blackjack. All open 24 hours a day and all online, including their $750,000 poker series. If you're into props and entertainment betting, you can still bet on Survivor, Big Brother, American Idol, stock prices, and even the weather. Visit their website and join today and receive a 100% welcome bonus with your first deposit. Be sure to use promo code BLUEWIRE, all one word. Bet online, your online wagering experts. All right, so episode 4 is called Old Cases, and it was written by David Simon, the show's creator, and it's when things start to coalesce a little bit. So let's kind of walk around from scene to scene. You know, we start out with Greggs and McNulty are at a hearing for Marvin Browning, and he's one of the Barksdale dealers, right? They just had that... they tried to get the stash. They had, you know, little bust and buy and bust operation, right? And where they...
Yeah, they tried to, like, they executed the raid. The raid, right? Like, that was right near the end of episode 3. That's where McNulty says, you know, I ain't going.
Right?
Uh-huh. And then they go and they kick in some doors and they look for the stash and they basically end up with nothing. Mm-hmm. They make some arrests, but it's just like, there's no stash. There's no heavy hitters around. There's no nothing. And so this new episode opens and there they are in court and they've got old dudes sitting there and they're trying to rough him up a little bit with some charges.
Right. Cause so he's got this long rap sheet and they're planning on throwing 5 years at him, which is the maximum sentence, which like gets his attention, right? When he hears the state say that they're going to be pursuing a 5-year term, what the hell? And you know, that's the leverage that Greggs and McNulty have with the purpose of trying to get him to sell out some of the, they're trying to roll him up, right? Trying to, do you got anything on Stringer, on Avon, on Weebay, any of the higher dudes in the organization? They're trying to use those lower level guys to roll him up. And so once Marvin realizes this, he's like, okay, he's like, oh, you know, Kima's like, okay, what? He's like, I'll take the years, which gives you an idea. And in that next scene, right, they talk about like, well, hey, they, you know, we visit the projects every once in a while and they live there. And it was just indicative of the weight that Avon Barksdale's name carries in the neighborhood. So, yeah. So that first scene, what does that kind of give us the idea of, you know, where both cops are and the Barksdales?
Well, I just think that the cops, to me, it signals that they're scrambling a little bit. Like they're making headway, but they're still trying to really get a real foothold on things.
But it's because of their bosses, right? They don't want like a real legit investigation at this point. They say, hey, put a little drugs on the table, do this and that. And so they do this like BS job of trying to like, the job was not done. And so you've got these two really good cops in McNulty and Greggs trying to, but they're so hamstrung by the people above them that they can't really do much. So they are scrambling.
Yes. And they want to make a good case. Right. And so they are turning to all the little tricks that they have, which in this case is trying to roll someone lower level up to get bigger fish in the fryer, right? And the flip side of that, though, is exactly what you said, is when he says, well, I'll take the years, and he says it in a way that's almost like condescending,
right? Is like
to them, right? like don't you know, like we're all here together, you should have known already. Mm-hmm. if you're coming at me with Avon's name and Stringer's name, you already know the heat those guys mm-hmm. can bring. Mm-hmm. And so did you really think I was going to turn on those dudes? And it was almost a light bulb moment for everyone there, mm-hmm. right? Like
yes.
Old Marvin's like, I'll take the years and I'll be fine with those years. Mm-hmm. And Greggs and McNulty are just like, ah,
Yeah.
Yeah, I guess it is going to be this hard.
Yeah. Well, it's right? What they expected, right? Like they, yes. And that, again, they're hamstrung by their superiors. So they don't get anything out of that. And then they cut to Polk and Mahone, who are the two of the worthless cops, right? And Mahone is in the hospital because Bodie knocked his ass out. By the way, there's going to be some cursing in the second half because there's an iconic scene at the end of this episode where we cannot use cover it properly without using some four-letter words.
Or one in particular.
One in particular, yes. Mahone is psyched because he can take 66 and two-thirds pension and go, you know, work at his brother-in-law's video store out in the county, make his money, and he's trying to talk Polk into doing the same, right? Now, I don't want to get too far into this, but just this scene in particular, I'm just like, these MFers, man, this is exactly like, their whole thing about like, oh, we deserve this. We really deserve this. Like, they haven't done their job in 10 years. But we all know people like that, in especially in like state institutions where it's like impossible to lose your job, that's the point that people get to. And then they're the ones that feel so aggrieved, right? And that they're deserving of such riches.
The level of entitlement with those two is just off the charts, right? And it's sort of hinted at in a previous episode when they ask about, like, who signs our OT, right?
That was the first question, right?
Yeah, and that's when they get told, basically, like, do some casework that requires some OT, and then you'll get it. Mm-hmm. And it's like, oh, man, like, this is what we got to deal with in this outfit? Like, come on now. Like, where's, basically, CTC, you know, I'll give you whatever I want, and... but you're going to be paying me anyway, right? So, like, let's cut the BS.
Right.
And so those two in the hospital, and when they're just sitting there drinking, in bed, man. And then Daniels walks in, and they're just like, come on, have a taste with us. And it's just such a classic sort of throwaway scene, but what you realize when you go through the wire, especially a second or a third time, there are no throwaway scenes.
All the pieces matter, right? Who's the guy that wrote the book on it?
Abrams.
Jonathan Abrams, right? Yeah.
Yes.
That's the name of the book that's about the wire and all that. And this is something just that's very, if you know me in my personal life, I say that phrase all the time, like all the details, all the pieces matter. And yes, every little scene is it's telling this broader overall story. Right. And these are people that exist in real life. That's part of what I enjoy about The Wire, is having worked a bunch of odd jobs throughout my almost 40 years on this planet. Just like, yeah, I know that guy, you know, and just how people emerge in certain systems and environments as a result of what happens around them, which brings us to, in some ways, the other side of what I see the entitlement scale as, somebody who has to be really good at his job because he robs drug dealers for a living. And that's Omar, right? And so the first scene with them, they're on a stoop, and it's Omar, Brandon, and Bailey, and they're, you know, talking about their play that they just got where they hit the Barksdale stash. Omar is kind of lamenting that Brandon called out his name, but you also find out in that scene that Omar is gay. And not only is Omar gay, Omar is very openly, it's not a behind closed doors, hush hush type thing. He's got his arm around his boyfriend. He's, you know, running his hands through his hair and whatnot on the doorstep in front of everybody. And that's his, you know, and so they're talking about their, you know, what their next move is going to be. And, you know, an addict comes over and asks, like, hey, you know, I think it's Miss Shirley is her name. And says, hey, my check is late. Can I have a fix? You know, and Omar gives it to her, full well knowing that she's not going to pay him back.
Oh, she's likely. She's not going to pay.
So this
at all.
So this, I think this scene and or that scene in particular kind of frames Omar as this kind of Robin Hood character. So anyway, I think there are a lot of dynamics in that scene. I was really curious to hear your thoughts on it.
Well, it's all kinds of different. I think that what Simon does there is he lays out the complexities of the character and all the sides of this guy in like this one masterful scene, right? And so, in fact, like, Omar's not lamenting that his name got called out. He actually said, "I don't even care. They know my name, right? Like, my name reigns in these streets. And so they call out my name, psh, whatever." Right. Like, that's just going to cast more fear for the next time, right? Like, Omar coming.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And we'll see that later.
We'll learn more about Omar coming later. But you know, so he sort of say, so in that image, you see him as, oh, he is the ultimate sort of gangster type, right? Mm-hmm. Like the no fear guy. But he's also the compassionate person who's running his fingers through his boyfriend's hair, mm-hmm. and he's gay. And so back then too, like, understand, what year was this? This was what, 2005 or six?
Something like that.
Right? Somewhere yeah. around there.
Let me look to see when this was released. But yeah.
So the connotations 2002. Around
2002.
Mm-hmm. So the connotations around like a gay man at that point, like there were no gay men portrayed like Omar Little.
Nope.
Right? Like who was going to be the, on one side he's gay and there are all these stereotypes that come with that. And that pops up in a scene later, mm-hmm. right?
Coming
when
up.
The Barksdales mm-hmm. are talking about Omar. Mm-hmm. But yet he's also the toughest dude who's robbing drug dealers. And then you can view him sort of having this compassion for the addict who comes up, and it's just like, because the other dude is just like, oh, here she come on her bullshit again, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. Like they already know when they see her walking up, carrying her baby almost like a prop
right.
to get sympathy,
right?
Right? Like, oh, Mr. Omar, my check is late.
Right.
And it's like, okay, like, you can have it. And Omar can come off as as sort of compassionate there, but really, is he being compassionate? He is basically giving an addict another hit to ensure that when she wants it again, she's going to come back.
Mm-hmm.
And I can almost guarantee she'll have money one of these times. Right, she'll be paid. She's gonna have somebody to
what I think it is. What I think stuff like that is a degree of compassion. The more cynical end is loyalty, right? Like, what is one hit at the end of the day from a financial standpoint to a guy like Omar, right? But in a guy like Omar, having the enemies that he has, needs to have people looking out for him too. And people understanding that, you know, like when he's on his home turf, wherever that might be, you know, he has the kid that's on his lookout, right? Like even a guy like Omar Little needs some loyalty and needs some people around him to protect him, right? Even if it's just to give him a 10-second heads up that some shit is coming his way, right?
No, that the heat is around the corner.
Exactly.
For sure. For sure.
The thing about Omar, as I said in the last episode, he's my favorite TV character of all time. And part of it is because he very much has a well-developed code that he adheres to, he believes in, and it is the what underlies his confidence, right? Like, he's gay. He ain't got any problem with anybody knowing it, right? He's got no shame in anything that he does or outside opinions of who he is. Because he has thought about every aspect of who he is and what he does. And there are things that he will do and there are things that he won't do. So he can proceed with confidence in any situation, knowing exactly the person that he is. And that was a scene that first really illustrated that. Now, you mentioned the scene soon thereafter of you've got kind of a meeting of the High Council of one of several basketball scenes in The Wire.
That's right.
And so you've got Avon Barksdale opens up the scene and he's talking about, like, you know how white people, when they go like hunting and kill a deer and they like sprawl that shit out on the hood, right? He's like, I want it to be like that. And he's always talking about putting out a hit out on not only Omar, but on Brandon and Bailey. And it starts out, he puts $2,000 on Omar and $1,000 each on Bailey and Brandon. And then I think it was was it Stinkum that says this? Yeah, Stinkum, who's one of the enforcers. It's Stinkum, Stringer, Weebe, also one of the enforcers, and Avon in this meeting. And he says, hey, you know, like, one of my boys was down locked up with him at Jessup, and he had a whole bunch of guys. He had a stable of boys down there, and they used some colorful language to describe that. But the takeaway from that was that you could see that Avon and Stringer's like manhood felt attacked, right? Like, not only did this guy get us, because they pride themselves. And so one of the themes of this episode, we might have to, Darius, we might have to cover this episode over two different episodes of this, because I love this episode so much. But one of the themes of this are competent people being attacked on their competence. There's a, and how they react to that. There's a scene with Kima later that we'll get to that plays into this theme as well, with No Hard Anthony and all of that. But Avon and Stringer pride themselves on running a tight ship, and they pride themselves on also being these like manly men of the projects, right? These kingpins and whatnot. Not only did they get got, they got by a gay man. And that, and once Avon finds out that Omar is gay, he doubles the price out on the hit, right? Like, it's an additional level of disrespect to him. So what were your takeaways from that scene?
No, just so watching it in hindsight too, right? Just in terms of where we are at and where society is going.
Yeah, such a different world,
Like colorful language, right? Like they're using slurs against Omar, right? To sort of describe his sexual orientation. They're words that we won't repeat here, but you know, they're strong. And it's this sense of like, we're already better than him, right? And we'll be able to handle him. So there is already a certain amount of confidence, right? So even when that scene ends, Weebe walks out and he's like, we on it. And Avon thinks it's going to be handled, and it's going to be handled soon. And like, we won't give away how things go, but over the course of this series, you will learn that it is quite hard to get Omar Little in any way, shape, or form. He is quite the elusive character. And so it's one of the first times that you start to see them put their sort of bravado up front, right? To this point, Avon has not portrayed himself as someone who is super wanting to be out there like that, right? But the way this scene started is just how you describe, is like, we want our names to sort of ring out in this situation, and we want everyone to remember that they cannot mess with us. Whereas, like, contrast that to that scene in the club where he's talking to D'Angelo that we talked about a couple of podcasts ago, where he says to him, like, I never been in jail, and I ain't trying to go, right? And so there's this balancing act that is super interesting to me within a character like Avon, where he is definitely taking pride in being sort of this kingpin in the streets, right? But then also understands that if you take that too far, that you can end up behind bars, right? But in this instance, I feel like his want for revenge is sort of outweighing all that. And it's an interesting turn this early in the series to sort of see how, oh, there are some things you just don't do.
Right. It's a matter of reputation, right? And there's a spectrum of that, of, right, if you're too showy and you're too, you know, trying to prove, you know, show everybody that you're a kingpin in these outward and flashy ways, yeah, you're going to expose yourself in ways that make you vulnerable. And Avon does not do that. And that's why he hasn't been to jail, is that he keeps a low profile. There's also reputation in a way that really matters, right? Is that so much of the, like, they just got hit by someone on the outside, And yeah. that's going to spread, word of that is going to spread, and that is going to attract other people looking like, hey, is there, are these guys weak? Can we get them somewhere else?
They do not want to be looked at as vulnerable.
Right.
Right. And it's the same as that scene that we did not talk about from it was either an episode ago or two episodes ago when Bubbles and his boy try to run that game by giving fake cash. Mm-hmm. Right. And this is sort of and then Bodhi like kicks dude's ass mm-hmm. and it's that same sort of show of force, mm-hmm. right? Like you try to get over on us and we're gonna come back 10 times as hard
right.
on you
to send a message to the next guy.
To send a message.
Yeah,
that's right.
That's right. And so speaking of Bubbles, we have been remiss in not bringing him up until now. Bubbles is a great character. The show is full of them. He is an addict, but he is turned informant by that incident that you talked about, right? Where his guy, I'm sorry, whose name escapes me right now, but yeah, so his guy got beaten up in that little game they were trying to run and got put in the hospital. And so Bubbles is trying to help the cops out to, you know, kind of these, he does not like how the Barksdale organization runs the streets, right? And that they're overly violent, that they do some unnecessary things. So he's looking to help them out. So he's riding in the car with Kima, right? And Kima is trying to find out more about, like, who's this Omar dude, right? Like, this guy just like stole from the Barksdales. What's his story? So she's new. She's only been on this beat for a few months. And there's so she's asking Bubbles. Bubbles has been on the streets for years, the streets of West Baltimore for years and years, and just kind of knows everything that's going down. So he's like, yeah, Omar's fierce. Like, he don't need a last name. It just kind of given her Omar's story. And she asks, well, who's his family? He's like, oh, you remember No Heart Anthony? And she's like, no, I don't know who that is. And Bubbles is like offended, right? They're like, you don't know who No Heart Anthony is? Like, I'm ashamed to be your snitch. And this really bothers Kima, right? And this is something you could see on her face. And then the next scene, they pull up, Bubbles is going from her car to McNulty's. And, you know, they drive up on driver's side and roll. And at the end, she's like, hey, do you know who No Heart Anthony is? And McNulty, being cut from similar cloth as Kima, but being on the beat for way longer than her, is like, oh yeah, and rattles off his address, what he's been busted on.
Now he pulled the stats like he was someone who had collected criminal cards, like way that like you might collect right. basketball cards.
He's averaging
right?
25 like, a game, right? Like 8 and 7. Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, like, oh, he went to Villanova. Right. right? Like
so he knows, and so Bubbles is in the background cracking up, like, and so it was that was another area where like Avon getting hit on his stash. That's something he prides himself both on his reputation, but also his competence at being good at his job. Kima experiences that too, right? Where there's no substitution for experience in being immersed in a world that, and that very much illustrated that. Now we've seen this chemistry being built with Kima and Greg's, with Kima and McNulty, but another guy starts to emerge with Lester Freeman, right? And so Freeman has kind of been doing his own thing for a bit, but has figured out how to clone the pagers. And there's a great scene where he's outside of the Barksdale organization and outside of the terrace, and he thinks that he's gotten D'Angelo Barksdale's pager. He's gone out there to confirm it. He texts him. D'Angelo goes to the payphone, calls his number. He hangs up. They're in. Lester Freeman is the guy I always razz you that you are Lester Freeman, right? This is always a fun game with The Wire, is who's your character and whatnot.
Which is not a dig. Lester is fantastic.
Yes.
Lester's a great character.
Lester is a great character. Absolutely. What have you up to this point taken from Lester Freeman?
So we talked about him a little bit last episode, right? About sort of like he seemed like he was a mope. as like McNulty would call him. And then he has that conversation with Bunk about him, and Bunk's just like, you know, like, oh, I thought you said they sent you a bunch of humps. And he's just like, well, they did, like, mm-hmm. that's Freeman. And then Bunk's just like, no, man, like, he's real police, mm-hmm. right? And he's like, well, what happened? And he said, oh, well, you'll have to ask Freeman. And so fast forward to this episode, and Freeman is again starting to show his chops as a police officer, right? And so you just explained what happened. Lester explains it himself a little bit later, but how he had pulled a pager number, and then he had then worked it all out. And Freeman continues to sort of show that he is going to be an integral part of where things go within this series, right? And so at first he's the guy who's just, you know, carving up and painting dollhouse furniture, like, oh, here's an armoire,
right?
Right. And then he's the guy who pulls the first photo of Avon, and then you see him sort of starting doing police work at the end of the raid, and now he's sort of executing that more and more in this episode that comes to the penultimate scene where they're talking about exactly what they need to do in order to ramp this case up.
So that, right? That's a great scene, right? And that's one where I think really speaks to how much we're affected by our work environments, especially, you know, the longer that we're at a job. We come to find out in one of the last scenes of the episode that Freeman is essentially McNulty's ghost of Christmas future, is that Freeman had been doing police work in homicide. He had been asked to keep a fence, and a fence is somebody who sells stolen merchandise, to keep a fence out of this case that he was making because he was the son of the newspaper editor, right? He was politically connected in some way, yeah. Like make this case without him, and he probably could have, but he files charges on this guy, makes him testify, and then gets sent to the pawn shop unit for years and years because that's where he didn't want to be because he didn't play the game, right? This is McNulty's future, is that he is pissing off powerful people.
That's right.
In the name of doing good police work and not caring about that. And Freeman already knows. He's like, they're going to ask you where you want to go. Keep your mouth shut.
My favorite line is when McNulty tells Freeman, he says, shit, Lester, you're back from the dead. and it's just a fantastic line, right? Because it's almost like when in White Man Can't Jump, where they figure out that Billy can actually play, mm-hmm. right? Like, that's what this has been like for Lester, right? Like, when in White Men Can't Jump, when they're like, give him the jump, and there he is, like, on the side.
Billy Hoyle.
And then he ends up being, like, the hustler, right?
Right.
And that's who Lester has sort of shown himself to be, mm-hmm. within the context of this unit. He is now showing that he is real police.
Well, it's also, right? Like, it's him from his perspective taking joy in his work for the first time in a long time. He's natural, that's when McNulty is like intrigued. So I'm sorry, let's backtrack a bit. So they have that scene where they're talking about the different steps they have to hit to get to justify a wire, right? To have exhaustion, and how cloning the pagers, he's proven that that's the only way that they can,
yeah.
get access into the Barksdale organization, all that. But that scene, when you zoom out a little bit, is to me about when you work with other competent people, you can really feed off of them, right?
Yeah.
And that it's something, there's something in the collaborative nature of doing that, when, like, that scene, different people are doing really good police work, and different people who have, like, either decided all of this is bullshit or have been, like, even Daniels's tune changes, right? Because Daniels is part politician, part cop, like, actual good cop. He's, like, doing good police work and organizing all of this. And, yeah, it's all of these good cops kind of coming together.
Well, he had that conversation, too, with Burrell, right?
Where
he was just like, you know, well, McNulty says that this case needs a wire. And then And even Burrell sort of softens for just a second. And he said, well, what do you think? Almost like he's almost open to the idea, mm-hmm. seemingly.
Right.
Right. And that's when Dan Daniels says, well, you know, it needs something. And so fast forward back to that scene. And this is where Lester sort of shows his chops again, right? Because there's this great sort of understanding, especially between Kima and McNulty, that they need to sort of flip Daniels mm-hmm. to get him on board, and that they're going to need to convince him. And they plan this, and they plan this out. McNulty tells Kima, like, okay, I need you to present this mm-hmm. because he trusts you. Mm-hmm. Like, if I go in there
right.
and say it, right, then he's not going to listen to me. But if it comes from you, it's going to be fine. And so Kima slow plays it perfectly. Mm-hmm. And then McNulty sort of jumps in right at the right time. And Daniel starts to feel like, huh, okay, you guys are telling me something mm-hmm. here. So, and then Daniels asks, well, do we even have a number to clone? Who has a pager number? Do you got one? And then they're looking at each other dumbfounded. You know, McNulty and Greggs, it's like getting to the final boss in like a video game, and suddenly he's got some weapon that you didn't know that he had, and it's right. like, oh shit, like I don't have an answer for this one. And then in comes Lester. He's like, yeah, I got this number.
Right.
Found it on the stash house wall. Mm-hmm. And then it's like, does it work? Yeah, I checked it out earlier today. Like, Lester's done all his homework. Uh-huh. And so when you talk about everything sort of coalescing, which was a great word at the beginning of us talking about this episode, to me, this is the scene where it all sort of comes together. Like, this group can actually maybe pull this thing off, mm-hmm. right? Like, we're super early into the series, but this is that sort of momentum building scene that shows you that they're about to get this thing rolling, and it can kick off in a big way here. And it gets you excited, mm-hmm. right?
Yeah.
For what can come next, because all of these folks are seemingly moving in the same direction now, especially with Daniels on board.
Very much so. But the thing that the police are lacking is leverage, which is what that first scene with Marvin Browning illustrated, is that, like, okay, great, but they don't have somebody that can really tell the stories of the organization. And so Freeman has latched on to D'Angelo Barksdale's pager. The other bit of leverage that they're getting over D'Angelo is illustrated, and they foretell it earlier in the episode. So Bodie has gone to juvie and out in county has the easiest, like, escape scene, right? And he's very obviously surrounded by hostile players, right? All these kids from D.C., and he's a Baltimore kid, and they're looking at him like they're about to tear him up. So he gets the hell out of Dodge, while Herc and Carver are telling themselves young man stories of delusions of grandeur on how they're going to break this case wide open by making Bodie cry or whatever, right? So Bodie steals a car, makes it back to the terrace, to the low rises, where Wallace and Poot and D'Angelo are sitting there. He's all, you know, Bodie's been all fucked up by the ass kicking he got from the cops and whatnot. But Bodie's coming back to talking, like, Bodie's kind of the Barksdale analog to Herc and Carver, right? This, like, young man who thinks he's, like, hot shit, right? And that he's got it all figured out when he doesn't. And so he's talking a little big, and he's said a couple of things and done a couple of things at this point that indicates that he thinks D'Angelo is soft. And so D'Angelo is trying to set him straight, telling him a story about this woman that he murdered, right? And he just paints this scene of kind of, he says, I got a little bit of creep to me, and my uncle knows that, right? So when he needed a job done and it was quiet in the shadows, he would go to D'Angelo, and this is one of those jobs. So she had been a girlfriend of Avon's, and she found out that she wasn't the only girlfriend of Avon's and got a little upset about that, started threatening. She was going to talk about some things about the Barksdales, right, and put them in hot water. So Avon sends D'Angelo out there to kill her. And he describes how he does it, right? From it being late at night, him tapping on the window loud enough so she can hear it and get up out of bed. And he shoots her in the kitchen of her apartment. So later in the episode, Bunk and McNulty go to look up this case, which they didn't want at all, and Landsman had plopped on their desk because he just wants some freaking clearances, right? Like, everybody's got their own motivations, and there's a great scene we probably won't even get to with Landsman and Rawls, where he's trying to get Rawls successfully to, like, back up off the case, and Landsman is very flowery and poetic with his words. Anyway, yeah, sorry, I can go on about this episode forever. Anyway, so Bunk and McNulty are retracing the six-month-old crime scene that was really shoddily done by Keeley, I think it was. And so there wasn't much done to it. And this is the fuck scene, right? Where they go a good 4 or 5 minutes where all they say is fuck in different versions of fuck. Fuck, motherfucker. You know, like all that.
All they do is change their tone. It's like watching a Magic Johnson passing highlight reel, and all you see is all of these different passes, and it's the same dude throwing the same type of pass, but he throws it 500 different ways, right? And every single time it's a highlight,
right? Yeah, it's
right. And that's what this scene is, but with the word fuck, because they go in and right from the beginning they're looking at the documentation that's in front of them, which is the case file, which is like as thin as,
right,
you know, it's like three pieces of paper and like a handful of pictures. And then they're looking at the scene and they're just like almost thinking to themselves, or at least the way that they say it, just by using the word fuck, mind you, mm-hmm, like this motherfucker didn't do anything, mm-hmm, with this. And like, what the fuck kind of job did... Are we supposed to do with this information? Mm-hmm. But there you go. And this is where offline you and I talk a lot. And I often use the word like subject matter experts, mm-hmm, right? And what this scene does is show you, the viewer, like, this is how good these guys are at their job. Mm-hmm. That's what this scene is great at doing. And so they are retracing the steps of the crime scene. Their only bit of dialogue is using the F word back and forth to each other over and over again, with heavy sighs in the middle and long drawn out. Right.
It illustrates their chemistry too, right? In that when you know somebody really well, it's just a look. It's just a little bit of inflection in your voice. As soon as McNulty figures out, and so what they're doing as they're doing this is they piece together exactly what happened. And you know, when he figures out, like, oh, he was standing on the porch, because like at first he's like, how did she get shot in the collar, just below the collarbone, but the exit wound was out her back, her lower back, and like at first
he thought, was she kneeling?
Right.
And this dude's above him, like
execution.
And he's got out a tape measure, and he's trying to figure out what the heights are.
Right.
And then they're starting to look at more pictures, and they start to see small little things in each one of these pictures that starts to, like, these are the breadcrumbs, right, that are leading them to the final answer.
But right, no, but absolutely. So yeah, so McNulty is figuring out, like, oh, it was from outside, because Bunk originally realizes that it's from outside. McNulty goes out there, taps on the window, just like D'Angelo said that he did. And as soon as he realizes, oh, it's from there, then Bunk takes the tape measure and, like, oh, we're going to go back 6 feet, right, and see if we can find the slug. And this is a low traffic area. The apartment hasn't been rented for 6 months. There's some things in the scene that are like, yeah, that's convenient, but hey, I'll roll with you on that. But yeah, it's one of the showier scenes, I think, but it definitely an iconic scene. And the point of it, in terms of what is taken away going forward, is that they now have some decent evidence in case that they can work back onto who they suspect to be D'Angelo Barksdale. So everything, again, starts to coalesce in this episode It's an all-time great episode of The Wire, and things really get moving from here on out. So thank you for joining us on this one. We'll be back in a couple of days to do episode 5. But until then, you've been listening to Laker Film Room Podcast. We will catch you guys next time.
Ains has got it in low to McHale. McHale wants to turn. He's double teamed. Just pass out of front, broken up by Worthy. Tip to Magic. Worthy dies on his belly. Magic scores.
There's Magic, got it. Magic fires. It's in. The Lakers win the game. The Lakers win the game.
Campbell in and out. The ball is tipped and it's saved. 3 seconds left. Here's Van Exel. This is for the win. He got it.
Kobe Bryant, 48 points, 16 rebounds. Amazing performance by Kobe. With his eighth block shot that ties an NBA Finals record.
A lot of Laker fans sticking around for this.
You're seeing something that's very rare indeed. A Laker to get MVP chance
in Boston.
In Boston.
Of all places.
Are you kidding me? I know Red Auerbach is rolling over.
Kobe. Hard to believe.
Are you kidding me? Unreal! Are you kidding me?
How strong was that? A triple on a fall away in the corner with a shot clock down.
Lakers by 3.
Bryant spinning in the lane. Back for Gasol. Freddie pass. And it's back to a 3-point game.
And the critical part was Pietrus jogging back. Didn't bounce the floor. It's a 2-for-1 situation.
Kobe Bryant picked up by Powell.
There's the move. 2-1.
Miss it!
Bryant, yes, and that was a little tough to Alvin Gentry.
Add insult to injury, Kobe. I mean, what a shot. I mean, you can't defend that. Are you kidding me?